Wildfires, dust, automotive exhaust, residential and agricultural burning. These are but a few of the factors elevating environmental pollution. Next to the water we drink, there is nothing more precious to human life than the air we breathe. Since 2013, Citizens for Clean Air has been working to better understand the scope and root causes of air pollution in the Grand Valley and uncover ways to improve the overall air quality throughout the region and help us all avoid the adverse health effects of breathing contaminated air. In an effort to curb the seasonal agricultural burning that has long been tradition for many local farmers, the organization has embarked on a biochar study to research its potential use as a lower-cost alternative to other non-burning methods of maintaining healthy fields. I was recently joined by members Karen Sjoberg and Jerry Nelson to discuss the details of their biochar experiment. Welcome to Season 4 of the official podcast of Crossing the Divide, a multimedia exploration of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide counters a media culture fixated on urbanism and elevates a region defined by open space, sweeping vistas, big skies, and natural wonder. I'm Gretchen Reist, guiding you over the divide and into the diverse terrain of the American West. Jerry and Karen, welcome to Crossing the Divide.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, you're here today as representatives of Citizens for Clean Air. But before we delve into the history and mission of that organization, I'd like to get a little bit of background information on both of you. So, Jerry, tell me about your work history, your career, and how it dovetails with the work of Citizens for Clean Air.
Sure. So I have a long and checkered work history, but I spent 20 odd years at the University of Illinois in the Agricultural Economics Department, and then 6 years in Washington, D.C., working for the International Food Policy Research Institute. So I'm an agricultural economist and interested in climate change, food security, those sorts of questions. And I got interested in clean air because in one of my early days in Grand Junction, I was coming back from a business trip and flew into the valley when the air was really awful. And I suspect we all remember that period of time. And so the question is, what can we do about it? And so that's what Citizens for Clean Air has been working on and continues to work on. The particular project that we, I believe, going to talk about today has to do with finding ways to deal with agricultural burning, which is an important source of air pollution sometimes of the year in the valley, and whether or not there are ways that we can deal with that to help both reduce the air pollution, but also in a way that's not too financially detrimental or possibly even positive for the farmers that are currently burning this agricultural product.
Right, Karen, how about you? How did you come to Citizens for Clean Air? You were a founder, I believe?
I had been retired from another nonprofit for a couple of years. And in the winter of 2012-2013, we had a particularly bad inversion. We had snow on the ground and the air was just terrible. The air was yellow. And I started getting sick. I developed a cough and bronchitis. And I went to a League of Women Voters meeting, and there was a commissioner there, and I wanted to ask him what the county was doing. He didn't believe there was much of a problem, and that started a conversation among the crowd. And I found out there were a lot of people who were concerned, as I am, and other people who were getting ill. And so we started meeting together, and so we've been working on this challenge ever since. We have some wonderful people in the group. We've attracted some really good team.
Of all of the factors that contribute to poor air quality here, because there are a number of them, where does agricultural and residential burning rank?
Well, let me back up just a second and talk about the different categories of air pollution that are potentially detrimental to human health. So when we talk about ag burning or burning more generally, we are concerned with mainly with the particulates, small pieces of the product that gets burned. Gets small enough that when you breathe it in, it goes into your lungs. And if it's really small, it actually gets into your bloodstream and eventually can even get into your brain. And doing so, it not only irritates as it goes through, but it carries chemicals on the surface of the particles that can then cause other kinds of health effects. So that's one thing. The other one is ozone. And ozone has a different kind of effect. It basically burns tissues. And so as you breathe it in, it burns your tissues and your lungs in particular. That's true not only for humans, though, by the way. That's plants have breathe in air. And so the ozone has negative effects on plants. And the same thing is true for animals, you know, our livestock and our pets also breathe in ozone. They're also affected by particulates as well. One other one that's a problem, potential problem, but we don't have any measurements on in the valley is nitrous oxides. And these are the kinds of things that were common in the LA smog days of the past. And probably a problem in smog periods around here, but we really don't know because we don't have any tests. So if you think about those two, at least three sources of particulates, the ag burning is a major contributor to particulates and probably a small contributor to ozone. We get, obviously, in the summertime, we get more particulates coming in from the wildfires, especially in the West. In the wintertime, we get some particulates from the wood fire heating that's done in the valley, and particularly in stoves that are not EPA certified. But even EPA certified stoves also put particulates in the air. Ozone is a gas that's created. It's not something that's naturally occurring, but it's created by natural processes. So plants, when they put off volatile organics, that stuff you smell when you're in forests, combines with ultraviolet and with a little bit of water moisture and creates ozone. It's short-lived, but you know, in the meantime, while it's alive, before it breaks down back into oxygen and natural gases, causes damage to everything. And so the question is, how much ozone? We have a local state-funded ozone monitor, and that's a problem in the summer. Ozone's a problem in the summer, unlike in, say, Salt Lake, where it's also a problem in the winter. So industrial pollution, automobiles, natural pollution from plants also cause ozone. And we don't really know how important the various sources of potential sources of ozone are. That's one of the things we're working on. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but it's really kind of a non-answer because in the various kinds of pollutants, you know, agricultural burning is important for some things, not for others, but magnitude-wise, we're still trying to figure that out.
Do either of you know where the practice of burning fields originated and what is it supposed to accomplish and is it effective?
Karen, you wanted to jump in on my long-winded answer on that.
I just wanted to add, we don't know really, we haven't discovered the source of the problems yet. We're working on that, but we do have, a lot of people are probably familiar with our air quality monitoring project. And we worked with placing purple air monitors across the valley, and they extended across the western slope, and there are many of them on the Front Range. We're working with Purple Air, a company out of Salt Lake City. And those air quality monitors that you can see on the Purple Air map, purpleair.com, or on our website homepage, indicate the number of particulates, which is what Jerry was talking about. And anyone can go and find out what the particulate counts are that day. And then we also have a project in the making, in the works, we have seven now ozone monitors, and those show us ozone levels throughout the valley. And that's a project that we started just a couple of years ago or last year. It's fairly recent, but it's a brand new effort. We were working with Purple Air to build these low-cost ozone monitors. Mm-hmm. And so we're working on being able to measure ozone levels as well. And so they're placed across the valley so that we'll be able to tell if there's one area that is consistently higher than other areas. And there's been some interesting results from that.
So what you're trying to do, where you are, I guess, in your own process of doing this, is first just figuring out what is bad and where, and to get a bigger picture of the air quality in total of the area.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. You can't deal with a problem that you don't know where it's coming from. And so the first thing is to try to figure out where the sources of these pollutants are coming from. You started to ask, Gretchen, about the practice of ag burning. You know, it's an age-old practice, and it's used in a lot of places still around the world as people try to get their fields ready for cultivation. And before we had tractors and even before we had animals, people were burning to clear forests, to make space available to put plants in the ground when we were doing agriculture. And animal traction helped expand agriculture, and then mechanical traction helped even more. But we still got the problem of you got these plants coming up where you want to put the ones you're really interested in instead of the those weeds out there that we don't like so much, at least if you're a farmer. And the process that it has evolved over time has made agricultural burning a low-cost way to get rid of those things. If you're going to run a tractor through a field to get rid of the weeds, that's going to cost you a lot of time and money. You stick a match on those dry weeds and burn them, and they get rid of the seeds and clear the fields and actually put a little bit of minerals back in the soil as well. So you get more minerals available from ag burning. So those are kind of the pros of doing agricultural burning. There's some cons too, which I hope we'll get to.
You can go ahead and
okay.
On that. Yeah.
So what you're doing is, all plants do is take sunlight and combine it with nutrients and produce this green stuff, right? And the nutrients that you'd like to see in the ground include organic material because they make the soil richer in a variety of ways. And so by burning, you actually lose that organic material. It goes up in smoke, so to speak. And you actually can have negative effects on the soil. If the burning is too intense, it actually damages the soil. And so there's these negative effects of agricultural burning. And the question that we're trying to figure out, is there some ways to reduce the cost of dealing with these weeds and other plant material more generally, and also potentially contribute to the productivity of the soil by putting more of that organic material back in the soil in a form that will stay there, but also reduce the potential for weed production. Lots of other issues around how you manage weeds too, and that's an issue for another discussion. But there's a lot of different ways you can do agriculture, and people are exploring all sorts of different ways now. And we're in a very unique environment agriculturally because basically it's a high desert, and there's no rain. So that's one issue. And the second one is that we are located in areas that used to be oceans. And so you got lots of salt deposits. And so we have salty soils and generally high alkalinity soils, which is not good for agriculture. You want to be you don't want to be too acidic either, which is a problem back east, but here it's the high alkalinity. So all of these issues are involved in managing the soils for farming. And burning is part of the practice that farmers have done here for quite a while.
The other thing is, with the onset of wildfires, like last summer, and we're holding our breaths and imagining that this summer may just be the same, the agricultural burning just exacerbates that. I mean, they weren't allowing any burning last summer at all because of the wildfires. So finding an alternative to that might benefit the farmers a great deal. But wildfires are a total another subject and a real, real challenge.
We're just going to ramble on here, right? The other issue that's unique around here in terms of agricultural burning relative to, let's say, the agriculture that you see on the other side of the Rockies, basically going back to the East Coast, is the, agriculture here doesn't exist without irrigation. And irrigation requires transporting waters from the main water source, which is the Colorado or the Gunnison, basically, out into fields. So that means you got a canal that's shaped like this, right? And you got water flowing through it. And so that's a kind of a nice environment for plants to grow. And then when the water gets to the fields and it runs off the field, goes into drainage ditches, then you get the same problem, that you got a nice environment for plants to grow. So a significant, but we don't know how much significant it, how big it is, a significant portion of the ag burning actually has to do with managing the irrigation canals and the drainage canals to get the water off the field, to keep the vegetation down so that the water will move freely to the fields and then from the fields back into the Colorado or into the groundwater.
So you mentioned that ag burning is still going on in various regions of the country and probably globally too. So that's not, I actually had never even heard of it before. I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and I didn't grow up in the heart of farming country, but certainly there's quite a bit of farming that goes on back there. And it was something I'd never heard of. That doesn't mean they don't do it. I had kind of operated under the assumption that maybe it was a little bit anachronistic to be doing this, but it still goes on. It's fairly common practice still.
You know, I spent a long time in Illinois, and they didn't burn farms there, fields in Illinois, and how they managed the agricultural waste. You know, if you're growing corn and soybeans, you got corn cobs and stalks and all that kind of stuff. The way they managed it for a long time was plowing it under. And that's A, expensive, and B, then you turn over the soil, which then means the organic material that's in the soil goes up in the air. And so you lose that organic material. And so what farmers in the Midwest are doing now to deal with their stubble, I suspect they were burning, but probably it's been quite a while since they burned. It's just leaving it on the field. Just leave it on the field and let it gradually decay over the wintertime. And then, you know, you plant, if you're doing, you know, low-till agriculture, you plant the seeds directly into that soil without disturbing it. If you go to the West Coast, one area that I was quite familiar with was that if you've ever driven I-80 between San Francisco, say, and Davis, there's a huge area of rice production. And they used to burn that rice, those rice fields in the fall, and drove. As that area became more and more urbanized, there was more and more pressure to stop that because of the air pollution. And so now the farmers do something else. So, you know, in some cases, what you're saying is absolutely correct. It was used in the past. It's become anachronistic. And partly that was the pressure from urban, you know, people. And partly it was the realization that there were other things that you could do. You go to other parts of the world, you know, well, places where income levels are lower and farming is much more of a marginal activity than it is here. And you still see quite a bit of burning. So, for example, in the Amazon, you know, you get lots and lots and lots of burning. And part of the issue was it combined with deforestation logging, you know, you had really big destruction, and you still do, of the Amazon forests that involved agriculture, involved burning.
Have you encountered resistance from people here as an organization who might
have
the idea that, well, you're just non-natives coming into an agricultural area and this is how we do things, and if you don't like it, then go somewhere else?
That's obvious.
A threat to, you know, how they operate and their livelihood?
Well, we see evidence of that whenever there's a letter to the editor complaining about the smoke produced from burning. And usually following that, there's a letter, at least one, from a farmer who says, if you moved here from Denver or from the East, then you should have known what you were moving into. And we've been doing this for years, and it's your problem, which isn't a really good argument, because the metro area is growing nonetheless, and smoke is bad for people's health. And we need to especially think about the health of our children and elderly and people with asthma. And I think what Mesa County is trying to do is get that across to farmers that have been, that continue to burn. Consider your neighbor, and they're trying to make people think twice before burning and look at the weather conditions and make sure that they're doing it correctly, because there are people that really suffer. We have heard stories from people who have asthma. And every time somebody's burning a wood stove or somebody's burning fields and it's coming into their house, they'll end up at the doctor's or the hospital's office. We've spoken to a doctor who specializes in asthma and respiratory diseases, and he's talked about the number of patients that go up exponentially during burn season. And when we have wildfires, he can't leave the office. During spring break, he testified once in front of the city council. He cannot leave because he's got so many patients coming to the office with respiratory problems because of the smoke. And I think people just don't realize what the trouble, the health issues that they're causing. And it's real, and it's problematic. And so we need to think before we do something that's going to influence our neighbors in a negative way.
Yeah, one thing that I think, Jerry, I think you both have brought up a number of times is that alternatives to burning can be very expensive. So as an organization, you clearly understand, and you've stated several times, that if you're going to ask farmers or to consider alternatives, then as an organization, you want to be able to put forth some viable, cost-effective alternatives to agro-burning. And this brings us to biochar. You have embarked on a biochar project. So first, I want to ask, what is biochar? And how did you come to this as an idea?
Sure. The interesting story from my past life was that I was actually in the Amazon on 9/11 of 1951. And there's a long story about why I was there and what it was like to be in Brazil when the American airspace was closed for a few weeks. But at the end of that trip, I was in Belen, which is on the towards the mouth of the Amazon, and I was in a bookstore just browsing around looking for something, and I found a reference to something called Terra Preta, which means black earth or dark earth, which is made by putting biochar, which is basically just charcoal, into the ground, and that Terra Preta was a major source of agricultural productivity in the Amazon, which before the Spanish arrived was really very heavily populated and quite deforested, as a matter of fact. And so that first brought it to my attention that there was this thing that you could put in the soil and it would stay in the soil, because one of the problems in tropical soils, it rains a lot and that takes all the nutrients down and washes them away. And what Terra Preta was doing was preserving those nutrients, because it's just basically plain old carbon with lots of pores in it. So there's places for stuff to get stored. And then I went back to Illinois, which is where I was at the time, and kind of paid a little bit of attention to biochar going forward. And there's been lots of different research on efforts on biochar, and it turns out to be quite a complex topic. I sort of had some idea that it was kind of complex, but I didn't realize just how complex it really is, and particularly thinking about using it here. But basically, it's just charcoal that you put in the soil, and you get that charcoal by taking plant material and you heat it up in an anaerobic environment, so no oxygen. So the carbon doesn't turn into carbon dioxide. And other stuff is driven off of the plant material that can become gaseous, and some of that's quite flammable. So what in a good biochar operation, you take that gas that's coming off of the material, use it to heat the process and get the biochar created in large part by using energy from the organic material. So that's kind of the magic of biochar. It's good for the soil, so to speak, and it was great in the Amazon, and it uses up this material. But then the complexities start to arise. And so the question is, what are the what's the chemical composition of biochar? And it turns out that biochar is not just carbon, because in plants there's minerals. And those don't vaporize. They stay in with the biochar. So there's some minerals in there. Not a lot, but there's also potential for high pH. And that means it's hot alkaline. I'm going to not be able to tell you much about the chemistry. But so biochar tends to be a higher pH. Depends on how it's made. And it also depends on, you can make really fine-grained biochar. You can make coarse biochar. All of these things depend on the process that you use. And then it has different effects in the soil. And so this is the challenge that we face right now. It's a great product on the surface. And if you go to Amazon and you look for a package of biochar for a pound, it'll cost you $8. So it's a potential moneymaker. And it also leaves carbon in the soil for quite a long time, as evidenced by the fact that you can still see the Terra Preta in the Amazon long after people had left. And so that is a potential another revenue source as we think about dealing with climate change. We want to keep carbon dioxide out of the air. So the idea is you keep the carbon in the ground for a long time. Lots of efforts going on right now to do that with plain old organic material. Farmers growing crops, leaving the cover crops on, the roots decay there in the soil. But that's still something that the microbes will eat, and eventually you get that stuff percolating up as carbon dioxide. Much less likely to happen with biochar, because the bugs like the organic material that combines carbon with oxygen and with nitrogen, and biochar doesn't have the oxygen and nitrogen. It's all gone away. So it stays there longer and provides this physical space for stuff to get stored, but is likely to stay there because, as I say, the bugs don't like it. The microorganisms don't like it. So those are some of the pros, but it's also some of the cons with biochar. Potential problems with biochar is the pH level, for one thing. And then if you make it, some of the stuff that's left in there, it's all minerals. So what kind of minerals might we be talking about? Well, we might be talking about salts, sodium chloride. Sodium and chloride are both stuff that stays around when you drive off all this other stuff. And there are other salts. And salts are generally not good for plants. So you don't want to have too much salts in your soil. And unfortunately, because of this fact that we were in an ocean environment 20 million years ago or 30 million years ago, where the salt settled out, we have lots of salt deposits around here. So our soils tend to be salty. Some places they're more salty than others, but you really don't want to be adding more salt into the soil around here. And so if you get biochar that has salts in it, you got a problem. And if you get biochar made from plants like, say, tamarisk, which are planted in part to suck the salt out, then you've got a heavy salt load coming with your biochar. So you need to think about biochar sources and how it's made. And then, how much do you apply to get the benefits but not have these negative effects? So lots of questions that we're discovering as we enter into this process.
So tell me, what is your process for this study? How is this going to work? What is your approach to, you're trying to figure out if it's effective and how to utilize it properly, I would imagine, as part
and
of
cost that. Effective and cost effective, right? So part of the cost effectiveness side is on the supply of biochar issues. As I said, you go to Amazon, it costs you $8 a pound. Well, that's going to be way too expensive for anybody to use on their fields. Well, why does it cost so much? Because the way it's currently being made in small quantities, it's also very expensive to make. You've got pretty heavy duty equipment because, you're heating this stuff really hot. It's between 800 and 1600 degrees Fahrenheit inside this container, which means you don't do it in your backyard, basically. You've got to have some pretty expensive equipment. And the question is, how much biochar can you, how big of an equipment do you need to do this? And then the other stuff is getting the raw material to the biochar machine, right? So, there was a big project at CSU called Banner, where there was an issue of whether or not you could take beetle kill from our forests around here and turn it into biochar, perhaps even leaving it in the forests around here or bringing it down. And the bottom line, I think, on that was that the cost calculations suggested that it was not going to work. It was going to just be way too expensive to haul the stuff down, and then you got to have a biochar machine. Plus, the other question is, so that's sort of the supply side, and this issue of both the machinery to make it and the cost of getting material to that. Then on the demand side, the question is, how do you use it? And there's also issues there. Most of the research that I've seen has to use pretty small amounts of biochar in a sort of percentage wise in terms of the soil. And that doesn't use up a lot of biochar that way. And so the question is, can you use more? And then that has its own complications. So what we decided to do was to focus first on the potential uses of the biochar. Where would it be good to use around here? And that's what we're right in the middle of getting ready for.
So we've purchased biochar mixes, we're calling them, from a business in Olathe. And we have his pure compost material. And then we have purchased a compost and biochar mix that has 10% biochar in it. And then we have another mix that has 20% biochar in it. And those three piles are sitting there waiting to be distributed to five different sites throughout the Grand Valley. And right now we're going around to these various sites and taking a look at what we've got to work with and preparing them for this experiment. And the plan right now is to have four different garden beds. And so we'll have one with the 10% mix, one with the 20, one with pure compost into the soil, and then one with no compost or mix at all. And so that will be the control. And so we're going around and preparing those sites. So far we have Santa Fe Ranch HOA. We have a farm out on 19 and a half in Fruta. We have another farm, CSA in Palisade, Green Junction. And then we are working also with a plot at CSU Extension and one at Cross Orchards Living History. So last Saturday, we were there doing some of the manual labor. And we're hoping to get more volunteers who aren't all over 60, because the next day we all kind of felt it. So it's been very, very interesting. And we have sent in some of the soil tests to Ward Laboratories, and we've gotten some of those results back. And we've had a comment on some of the results. We still have a couple of more soil tests to send in. So we've started that part of it. We're definitely learning as we go along.
Are you finding, as you work with farmers, that and I'm actually pulling some of this from a podcast I had done a couple of years ago with a rancher here who is doing grass-fed beef, but she had noted that in agriculture right now there is a kind of a new wave of people who are coming in and wanting to work with the land, but they're coming from many other fields, not necessarily agriculture. Are you finding that among some of these newer, more entrepreneurial farmers that there's less resistance to some of these ideas?
I can't say that generally, but the people that I have talked to, and there have only been a few, but very much so, they're young people. And they're enthused and they've got a lot of energy and they're coming from other fields, no pun intended. Yeah. And they're very excited about regenerative farming, which is the new word. And so it's they're the ones that we're actually working with, because some of the more traditional farmers, those are the ones we're trying to speak to. But the new people coming in are the ones that are open to new ideas and really anxious to try this.
I would have to imagine, I know even in some of the letters to the editor that I've read, that if this is something that you grew up with, if it's something you've always done, you have a connection to that. I think I've even read where people say, I love this smell. It you know, it has a memory for them, or it has meaning for them. It's a changing of seasons.
Sure.
But with people who don't have that history, I would have to imagine there would likely be a little bit more openness, just because they don't have that deep connection to it.
That's right.
And I think the demography of farming is also part of the story here as well. The farm community age is significantly higher than the non-farm community age in this country. Farmers are just old, and they are in a profession where they're working hard and spending a lot of time. And you know, as you get towards the end of your career, trying something new is not as interesting as when you're in the beginning of your career. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, it's worked for me in the past, and you know, I don't know how much longer I'm going to do this, and I'm worried about who's going to take over my farm because my kids don't want a farm. So I'm just going to continue doing what I'm doing now until, you know, something happens that I can find a way to transfer the value of the assets to the next generation somewhere or another. So, you know, I totally get that view. And the question is, you know, can we work with those folks? And I would say the other interesting thing about this valley is that there's a certain amount of an east-west effect going on here as well. Turns out that the orchards used to burn, but they don't burn much anymore. They actually chip and put that stuff back in between the rows of their plants for the most part. It's more people that are on the north side and the south and the west side of the valley that where we tend to see the agricultural burning smoke piles in the springtime and sometimes in the fall. And there's a different kind of agriculture. I mean, you know, orchards is one thing, and the field crops that you see at the other is quite a different thing. And so, you know, it's way too complicated here. You know, it's much easier in Illinois where you just got corn and soybeans as far as the eye can see, right?
So you mentioned that among some of the newer farmers, there is some interest in alternatives or changing some of those practices. I'm curious if you collaborate at all with members of the outdoor recreation and tourism industries, which I would think are directly impacted by some of the burning that goes on. The springtime is big mountain biking. It's not too pleasant to come out here and be inundated with smoke if you want to go out and do some riding. Or is there interest from entities beyond just farming that are looking at this and saying, yes, we support this idea of looking for alternatives?
Oh, definitely. We've gotten support from the outdoor recreation communities. And we're kind of deep in our own weeds, again, so to speak, and they're doing their thing. But we get support from, I mean, that's definitely one of the disadvantages of having smoke in the air. When people come here from the other side of the mountains or anywhere to ride their bikes or hike or camp, and you see smoke plumes in the air, that's not a good thing. One of our members used to work for the Visitors Association or the Visitors Center, and she said people used to come in during the spring and say, what's all the smoke around here? And she used to say, well, it's agricultural burning, and they didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was. And so as the outdoor recreation and tourism industry grows, we're going to have to do something about that. And we're trying. And I think that some of the city governments realize that. And I know the health department does too. And so I think that there's a slow process of trying to alleviate some of that. I wish it would happen sooner than later, and it just may be forced to due to the wildfires and other circumstances.
Karen, had you mentioned that there was some interest from the landfill as well, that they were, can you talk about that?
I can talk about it, and then I'll turn it over to Jerry because I don't know the details. Jerry was really involved in a lot of the research along with a couple of other of our members, and the landfill was especially interested because they, you know, they have the compost piles, and they make Mesa, what's it called?
Mesa Magic.
Thank you, yeah. Mesa Magic. And so they were interested in the project, but it turns out that they did it on such a large scale that we couldn't afford to purchase enough biochar product for them. And so then we went to a smaller scale. We found this company in Olathe. But they are still interested in the results. And actually, there might be an opportunity to enhance Mesa Magic, but we don't know. Isn't that right, Jerry? Would you like to add to that?
Yeah. And I need to excuse myself because of my bad time management. I've overscheduled two things over this. So I apologize and thank you for having us, Gretchen. And I'll leave Karen here to answer the rest of the questions if that's okay.
That's great. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Okay. Glad to see you, Jerry.
Bye. So Jerry is the scientist in the group, and he's obviously he was pushing for this as an alternative. He's been pushing for it for a long time. And finally, we received some funding for a project. And we looked at three things that we had in mind that we could possibly go into. And the biochar project ended up being it. And so we thought, well, we have some funding. Let's go. And so here we are. But the funding was from the Western Colorado Community Foundation, Dave and Mary Wood Fund. And they were generous to give us this opportunity. And it was just the incentive we needed, actually, after the pandemic and spending all this time, you know, in the house. And now we're getting out, working outside. And it is just the ideal time to be doing this. We got the funding in January. So it's worked out really great. And it's turned out to be actually quite fun.
Yeah. It's an added benefit, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I think when Jerry first came on, he mentioned something about he just got some bad news about biochar. Do you know what that is? Do you want to talk about that at all?
And I, you know, he's the interpreter. A lot of the science, I'm not quite sure what it means, but we did get some soil tests back from Ward Laboratories, and we're trying to interpret what it all means. And we got word from CSU that a lot of it had too much salt content, mm-hmm. And that the organic materials were too high. I have no idea what that means. Mm-hmm. And so Jerry has said that it's a possibility that they didn't quite know what we were doing, what we were trying to find out. So he's going to have a conversation with them. So the answer is, I don't know really what's going on, but we'll find out more. And then we'll let our, you know, now we're starting a dialogue with the various sites located around the valley. So we'll let everybody know what we find out as we find out. And we do have some experts involved in it, which we are very grateful for, because we need their input. So we'll find out more as we analyze those results.
Is there anything that I've missed, Karen, or any other thoughts you want to leave us with regard to this project or Citizens for Clean Air?
Well, I'd like to add that we could really use some more volunteers. So our website is citizensforcleanair.org. And if anyone is interested, this is gardening work, and this is on the ground. Young people are welcome. Students are welcome. As I said, we're all over 60, and spending a day working in the garden is definitely the next day we were all emailing back and forth saying, how are you? So we could use some help. And our website has the results, a daily readout, a live read of the air quality in the Grand Valley. And that became so important last summer, especially due to the wildfire season. And we did have another effort. We spearheaded an effort for the city of Grand Junction to put further restrictions on residential open burning. And so agricultural burning is sort of a different animal. But residential burning is something that we all can do without. We can, if you're gardening, you can have composts, you can take it out to the landfill. You can just use it, spread it on your land, you know, the organic materials. You can put it out in your trash, for heaven's sakes, but we have people burning in their backyards. And so the city of Grand Junction put restrictions on that. And we were, I'd say, instrumental in helping to make that happen and very proud of that. And that was followed soon after by Mesa County, the health department. And because it made no sense to have restrictions in within the city limits and then the county doing something else. So the county turned it into a nuisance law. And now the laws are similar. So residential burning, unless you have an acre or more, is unlawful in Grand Valley.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. As always, you can access our full lineup of conversations with Western Voices by searching Crossing the Divide on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and now on Amazon Music and Audible. Hit subscribe to stay plugged in to each new episode. Follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to keep up on podcast releases and access exclusive video and photography. Crossing the Divide, a voice for the Intermountain West.